Good morning, everyone. My name is Ryan Schmorhorn. I am an executive committee member of the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. I'm a Chicago Bears fan, in case anyone was wondering. We're hoping to have a Hall of Fame quarterback for once, just like the Colts and the Packers have had in recent years. But it is my honor to introduce the moderator for our second panel, which will focus on school choice, and that is Judge Sarah Pitlick. Right here. She serves on the United States District Court for the Eastern District of Missouri. Wikipedia told me that she was born in Indianapolis. I have since confirmed that that is indeed true, and she grew up here. Judge Pitlick obtained her BA from Boston College, Master's of Arts from Georgetown and KU Leuven. Did I say that right? Okay, in Belgium. She's a Fulbright scholar, and then proceeded to get her JD from Yale. She clerked for then-judge, now Justice, Kavanaugh, and then went into private practice before President Trump appointed her to the bench in 2019. So, Judge Pitlick, please take it away.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the Federalist Society, of course, for inviting me to be to host this panel and for consistently providing such rich content to the legal community. It's an honor to get to contribute even in the small way that I will today, and especially to get to introduce our distinguished panelists. I'll say first that I'm sorry I'm not as funny as Judge McFarland. Definitely not. But I am, as noted, a born and bred Hoosier. So I hope that I will engender some goodwill on that basis. And having been, just to elaborate on that a little bit, I went to St. Monica School up Michigan Road from K through 8. I went to Cathedral High School. My twin sister and I graduated from Cathedral High School. She's in the back there. And we both traveled together from St. Louis, where we now live. And she's lived there for quite a long time, a few decades. I've lived there for only one. Having lived in St. Louis for that long, I want to say I'm pleased to be back in a place where Hoosier is not used as a pejorative. Consistently cringe at the use of that word there. I have two brothers who are Boilermakers. I'll say that too. And so I was delighted, especially to be invited to Indianapolis for this purpose. Any excuse to visit my parents. All right. As to the more important members of the panel up here, I'm going to go ahead and provide all their biographies up front and then let them have at it. This is a very distinguished panel of experts on this topic, and I'm enthusiastic about hearing what they have to say, and I'm sure you are too. So without further ado, Leslie Davis Heiner, am I saying that correctly? Okay. Ms. Heiner is the Vice President of Legal Affairs and Director of Legal Defense and Education Center for EdChoice. She has extensive state legislative and executive branch experience, and in the past she's been a small business owner and a litigator in private practice. Ms. Heiner was a founding board member of one of Indiana's first charter schools and served as chairman of the board of that school for its first several years. She was also involved in developing Indiana's original charter school law and Indiana's voucher law. Ms. Heiner is a frequent speaker on educational issues. She's been cited in many notable publications and has appeared on many television and radio programs and podcasts. And this is a good point for me to stop and say that their accomplishments far exceed what I'm going to actually tell you today in the interest of time. So I encourage you all to look them up online or elsewhere and see all the details of everything that they've done, because it's really impressive. Ms. Heiner's also a Midwesterner. She's from Ohio. And she got her undergraduate degree from the College of Worcester and her law degree from the University of Akron School of Law. All right, and then Seamus Boyce is a partner at Kroger, Gardis, and Regus LLP. He's been practicing law since 2006, focusing in education and public policy. He's a frequent presenter, writer, and contributor for many organizations. He's active in the Indiana State Bar Association and in the Indiana Bar Foundation, having received the IBF's William G. Baker recognition for outstanding dedication to citizenship education. He's served on the board of the National Council of School Attorneys and was the first chairman of the Indiana Council of School Attorneys. He is an Indianapolis native, like me, and he attended Wabash College before earning a law degree and a master's in education law from the University of New Hampshire School of Law. And then finally, I have Daniel Suhr, who is a is this current and senior fellow at the National Opportunity Project. I understand you recently switched gigs. Is that correct? Okay. He previously served as managing attorney at the Liberty Justice Center, where he worked to advance education reform and to protect privacy and free speech. Before that, he worked as policy director for Governor Scott Walker, as chief of staff for Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish, and as a, thank you, and as a law clerk for Judge Diane Sykes, and he holds both a BA and a JD from Marquette University, go Jesuits, and master's degrees from Georgetown University, like me also, and the University of Missouri. So lots of connections, and I'm going to, with that, hand it over to Leslie, who's going to start us off. Thank you.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone for being here today. It's kind of fun to see some old friends that I don't get to see very often. When Mark Shublack stood up, that was like my past coming back to say hello, and that was very nice. In my role at EdChoice, I do travel the country and travel internationally for this work. So I don't get to see a lot of my Hoosier friends often, but this is a real treat. So EdChoice was originally named the Milton and Rose Friedman Foundation for Educational Choice. Our organization was founded by the Nobel laureate economist Milton Friedman and his wife, Rose. And so in my work, my job is to carry forward the legacy of Milton and Rose Friedman. Now, in the educational context, that's pretty darned important. So let me explain this to you. Most people around the country, if they know Milton Friedman, they know him as one of the greatest economists that we've seen in the last 150 years, the man who saved capitalism and the free market in the mid-1970s, that guy. But he also did something rather stupendous. In 1955, he wrote an article called The Role of Government in Education. Milton was asked to take a look at the manner in which the states fund education, and he was horrified by what he found. He was quite shocked to find that the way that we fund public education is actually a socialist methodology. And he couldn't understand why that was even happening in a capitalist economy. And so his prediction at that time in 1955 was simply this, that if we continued to fund education in this manner, that over time, the result would be mediocrity. Well, today, there are plenty of places where parents wish their schools were mediocre because that would be better. In fact, Milton was, like he so often was, he was right. And the simple reason, there are two simple reasons for this. Under the funding methodology that we have, the state's controlling the money. So the parents are not controlling the money, and so they don't feel that ownership. And everything is monopolized. And those two things alone would be enough to produce mediocrity. Now, Milton said in The Role of Government in Education something that has actually been accepted by the courts across this country, although they never mention Milton. But let me tell you what he said. He said that we should have a voucher system in the country, and it would be a voucher system for every parent on behalf of every child to be used to pay for any and all education, whether the parent chose to send the child to a public school, private school, or, as he said in 1955, ways of educating children that today we can't even imagine. He was right about that too. So he said this, the government would give a sum of money to the parents on behalf of the child. Now think about this for a minute. The legislature today appropriates funds for the education of every child. So that sum of money that the legislature has appropriated for education would go to the parent. on behalf of the child to be used solely for the child's education. And at that point, when the parent would control the funds and choose how the child was to be educated, that would be strictly the parent's choice. Now, that's what Milton wrote in 1955, but I'm here to tell you that there have been, in the last 20 years, I counted about 43 school choice cases that have been litigated. And in those cases, in all but five, the courts have relied on that same reasoning. So you will see that for the 34 states plus DC plus Puerto Rico, who today have some form of school choice, they use this simple system. Money goes to parents, parents choose education, and the parent's choice is, in fact, the parent's choice and not the government's choice. Now, I would like at some point for some judge to say, oh yeah, Milton Friedman mentioned this back in 1955. I think I may still be waiting for a long time. They never mentioned Milton. But that is a core finding of the courts in all of these cases. Now, it rests on a case that Emily spoke to earlier, which is the Pierce versus Society of Sisters case from 1925. The background of that case, I think, is really interesting. That was in the 1920s, that's when the compulsory education movement began across the country, or really was at its zenith at that point. So states were adopting these laws saying children must go to school. Well, that was fine, except then somebody got the bright idea that, oh, if children had to go to public schools only, well, then we could control, the state could control what the children were learning and how they were learning it. Now, at the time, we'd been through a world war. There was extensive immigration. There still was a lot of Catholic animus across the country. And so for a lot of people, this seemed like a good idea. Well, Oregon took the first step, the state of Oregon. They went forward and said children could only be educated in public schools. So some nuns stepped up. Nuns have been very instrumental in many of these cases, including the healthcare case that Todd Rakita mentioned earlier. It was nuns who stepped up to say, no, I don't think this is right. That's what happened in Oregon. They had a school. They were serving a lot of children with really extreme needs, and they had to close as a result of this new law. And they said no. So they fought it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So this compulsory education issue, you should know that the backdrop of this was simply this. That was also a time when the KKK was also at its zenith in this country. It was extremely strong in Oregon and in Maine in particular, and all points in between. So strong that politicians in Oregon, if you were going to run for office in Oregon, you wanted to make sure that you had your picture taken standing next to some guy who was wearing a white robe and a white mask and a white hat. They were that strong and that accepted, and they were fully behind this compulsory education movement. So the court said, as Emily said, the children are not just the mere creatures of the state, but the court also said that children are not bound to be educated by public school teachers only. Parents have the natural and constitutional right to decide how their children are educated. So that's almost 100 years ago. That's still good case law. That's still being cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. Daniel will be speaking to a couple U.S. Supreme Court cases that we've had recently where the Pierce case has been invoked, and I'm awfully darn happy about that. So now what's happened? It's not 1955 anymore. What happened? In 1990, we had the first modern day voucher passed in the city of Milwaukee. But I hasten to add the first two voucher programs were first enacted in 1879 in Vermont, and 1869 in Vermont, 1873 in Maine. They call them town tuitioning programs. There are a variety of vouchers. But the modern day voucher is 1990. There are tax credit scholarship programs. Many of the states here have these programs, including Indiana. The first one was enacted by Arizona in 1997. The first education savings account, which is the new, kind of the new favorite for a lot of states right now, was first enacted in Arizona in 2011. Just last year, the first truly universal school choice program was enacted by the state of Arizona. They have an education savings account program where the parent can use funding to pay for tuition at a private school or not, or pay for vendors to provide education. So I want this math teacher over here that I'm going to hire. I want this tutor over here. My child needs this kind of learning therapy over here. And so the parents have maximum flexibility to design, in fact, how their children are educated. And parents love this, let me tell you. There's some question whether parents would know how to do it. Yeah, they know how to do it. They know what their kids need. It works. So truly universal, every single child in the state of Arizona, there are no caps on this program. If you want to do this, you can do this. So from 1955 to 2022 was kind of a long time, but here we are. And just this year, Oklahoma adopted the first universal, again, refundable tax credit. Milton Friedman called refundable tax credits vouchers using the tax code. It's essentially the same thing. Oklahoma has a way to front-end the payments on that for a family who is poor and cannot afford to first pay and then be reimbursed. There's a system so the state can front-end the payments to families in economic need so that literally everyone can send their children to whatever educational resource they believe is right for them. This last year, honestly, if you've seen me in any state, you've seen me like running my legs off. States are going crazy right now for education savings accounts. We also had, last year, we had West Virginia adopted a universal education savings account. This year, we've had Iowa, Arkansas, Utah, Florida has consolidated and expanded theirs. We have a couple that we're still waiting on. Nebraska is a new school choice state this year. Texas ought to be. Texas is a case. Anyhow, we're struggling with Texas. It should have been one of the first states. But maybe this year. Governor Abbott has been a real champion down there. And, you know, God bless him. I think that they're going to find their way. But what this really means is there are only 16 states now that don't have school choice. So we've definitely swung the momentum in our direction, which is pretty fun. I can tell you that there are some states that we're watching on the list right now for this next year, Colorado, North Dakota, New Mexico, Oregon through referendum, Texas, of course, Wyoming, and Kentucky also. Now, where it's often the case that we get sued, not always, but often. But out of these 43 cases that I mentioned to you that I counted up over the last 20 years, there are only 5 cases that we lost. And in those 5 cases, 4 of those states have vigorous school choice today. The 5th one is Kentucky. That was a recent loss. But people in Kentucky are very actively right now finding their way forward to adopt school choice that's going to satisfy their constitution. So the track record is on our side. which is to tell you that when you hear any of your compatriots in the law that say, oh, none of this is constitutional. Oh, no, you know, that's separation of church and state, blah, blah, blah. No, that would be incorrect. In fact, the Constitution is on our side. Or as Pat Rooney, who was from Indianapolis, the person who started the nation's first scholarship-granting organization, upon which now there's some 85 other models of this across the country, he said, we're on the side of the angels. And as we're fighting for parental rights across the country, because that's really what we're talking about here, don't ever forget that. I tell people all the time, whenever you're litigating or you're advocating for school choice, if you can place a child in front of your view and keep your focus on that child and what that child may need, you're going to be okay. You're going to figure out the litigation. You're going to find the arguments. You're going to find the way to convince the legislature. It's going to happen. But the moment that that picture moves out of your vision and you have some other reasons for litigating or for advocating, it's not going to end well. School choice works because kids need it and parents want it. Thank you.
All right, next, Mr. Boyce.
Name is Seamus Boyce. You don't usually hear the name Seamus in Indiana. You can tell by my Irish brogue, I'm a Hoosier. I actually went to Cathedral as well, and I have a lot of school choices in my past. Although my dad chose my name, I'm the youngest of nine. My older siblings are Paul, Mike, Pat, Molly, Kathy, Peggy, Tom, and then Seamus. I didn't choose Seamus. But I then went to 1 year of Indianapolis Public Schools in kindergarten, and then again continued to have at least some preference to go to a Catholic education across the street at Immaculate Heart of Mary in elementary school. Then I went to Cathedral, and then I went to Wabash. And side note, if you didn't catch it already, this is the third program with a Wabash alum in it, Todd Rakita and Tom Fisher. And I didn't notice anybody in the last panel, but I did see other Wabash people out there. So you could volunteer to get on that last panel. I was always interested in education policy, more interested in the policy side before the legal side, but the legal part has grown on me. But I actually sought out an education policy program at the University of New Hampshire, and then got my concurrent degree in education law and my law degree. So I didn't know this at the time, but there's a strong connection between Indiana education policy and New Hampshire. And that is that Caleb Mills was one of the Christian preachers that was on a mission to bring literacy to the new frontier, which was Indiana at the time. He came to Indiana and was quickly asked to become one of the founders of Wabash. So he went to Dartmouth. Came over to Indiana, and he then became probably the first education lobbyist in Indiana, and created the first public education system in Indiana, all with the major objective of our people can't read. I think 50% of the population was illiterate at that time, and the schools were funded through township system, where the townships would have the opportunity to clear the timber in the township and sell the timber to pay for the public education and create the one-room schoolhouses. So that's the connections between New Hampshire and Wabash and Indiana for education policy. And since then, things have changed, haven't they? Lots of different opportunities, lots of different choices. And one additional choice that I made was that I wanted to work with all the education entities. I wanted to look for the common interests that were helpful to everybody. So I think you can blame Leslie for me being on the panel because she was trying to think about somebody who could see things from a lot of different perspectives. And I think I do. So I represent non-public schools. I represent non-public schools that receive public dollars. I represent occasionally parents, not too often. I represent charter schools, innovation network schools, traditional school corporations in urban areas, traditional school corporations, rural areas, and traditional school corporations, suburban areas. So I like the fact that I see all the different perspectives, and I like the fact that I can actually bring together my clients that have different perspectives and develop coalitions and develop focus groups where they can share ideas. What we may not agree on everything, but we're all in it to have good education policy for our children. And one of the biggest common interests I think that is out there, and I think that all the educational entities, all the school leaders out there should be really advocating for, hopefully with common talking points, is the education profession. I think that all the schools that are out there, whatever the form, they're all wringing their hands at the lack of a qualified applicant pool for educators. And there are certain areas that are certainly more concerning than others. I think the most recent anecdotal feedback from talking to school leaders in this past hiring season, it's almost impossible to find a middle school teacher, particularly a middle school teacher that is has a background in STEM, special education middle school teachers, school counselors. And, you know, I use the term educator very broadly. It's everybody that has a role in that kid's education. Bus drivers. It is incredibly difficult to find bus drivers because as soon as they get hired, they start to get recruited by the trucking industry where they can get benefits and get a six-figure salary. So I think that is one of the areas that I am hopeful that despite, you know, the differing views on policy that the different entities can come together and find out some way to make it more appealing to become a teacher, to become a professional in education. And right now it's not. And that's due to a lot of reasons. Some of it's optics, some of it's real. A lot of it's compensation. But just like every industry has its difficulty, I think we definitely need to see the opportunity to say, all right, how are we going to get our educator prep programs, our post-secondary educator prep programs, to make their education programs much more appealing, do a better job recruiting, do a better job of training. I mean, there's a lot of changes and developments in education, particularly one recent example that a lot of you probably have heard is the science of reading. And you've made a listened to some podcasts, read some books, The Knowledge Gap, Sold a Story. I think those are some of the ones that have received the most attention. But the fact that we have educator prep programs that are still not using the science of reading, that are not teaching their students to be using the science of reading in their programs, that's a major problem because I think talk about common interests, all the different groups I think would look at that and say that method has to be a fundamental for everything. If we don't teach our kids how to read by the third grade, the evidence is fairly clear that they're going to have an uphill battle in life. They're going to have a much higher rate of being in the juvenile justice system and then being in the justice system in general. So another area where I think we have to come together to put pressure on our educator prep programs, whether they're large public institutions or small liberal arts colleges. And, you know, that's another problem is I'll reference Wabash again, that had a long-term educator prep program, but they just didn't have the interest. They no longer have an educator prep program. And I think you're seeing more and more of those colleges and universities going away from it because it's not marketable. That is the one point of emphasis that I wanted to make today, because I think that there's probably a lot of people in the room that have involvement with different organizations and our stakeholders, and maybe throw out and plant that seed to say, how can we do a better job of telling our youth that it's a good thing to become an educator? Just because you hear about, you know, the state of affairs in schools, regardless of what the school is, it might be tough, but it's worth it. And we're going to change the policies to even incentivize it to make it better than the way it is right now. I have plenty of thoughts on a variety of things related to school choice. I think it was referenced back to the last panel, some of the topics that were out there, but I'll be happy to address any follow-up questions. Thanks.
Daniel.
Yeah. Good morning. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. It's a pleasure to be in front of you informally. Mm-hmm. If you ever become a one-judge division, it would be a pleasure to be in front of you formally. It's also great to be with Leslie, although I should warn you, the last time Leslie and I were at an education reform conference she hosted, there was an open bar of craft bourbon at the end of it. So not to raise expectations for later. So my role is to talk about startup schools. Sometimes we call them micro schools. And so I turned to the most authoritative source on micro schools. I put into Google New York Times pandemic pod. I read the New York Times, so you don't have to. So I want to read for you a few headlines from the New York Times over the course of the past 2 years. August 11th, 2021, pining for the intimacy of pandemic pods. August 28th, 2020. What happens when no one invites you to their pandemic pod? A real problem, I hear. August 18th, 2020. Pods, micro schools, and tutors. Can parents solve the education crisis on their own? Gasp. May 21st, 2021. It might be time to break up your pandemic pod. July 22nd, 2020, opinion. The latest in school segregation, private pandemic pods. October 14th, 2020. This is how many times the Times has reported on this. I'm still going. October 14th, 2020. In pandemic's wake, learning pods and micro schools take root. December 31st, 2020. Learning pods show their cracks. And finally, May 7th, 2021, the pandemic pod that became permanent. So I want to talk about micro schools, startup schools, pod schools, because they have become permanent. I think one of the reasons the New York Times, by the way, struggles with how to do this is that so many of these pandemic pods were started by liberals, right? They were in school districts like Chicago that were shut down, and they were shut down for a long time. And so they started getting together in their neighborhoods with just six or eight families and having these pandemic pods. And so the New York Times just doesn't know whether to be critical of them because the teachers' unions hate them, or whether or not to annoy their readers who live in places like Chicago, who are upper middle class whites who live in cities and were actually doing it. But the reality is, either way, that pandemic pods are permanent. We've just seen a nascent move across the country to revive essentially the one-room schoolhouse. This is very exciting. This is something we as conservatives and libertarians and believers in education reform should be champions of. But the reality is for us as lawyers, this has also created regulatory problems, right? Another insight I'm sure of Milton Friedman is that if there is something that is moving, there's a bureaucrat out there who wants to regulate it. And that has become true of pandemic pods, that there are these weird things and they don't fit in any of our natural boxes. But somewhere, somehow, we must be able to regulate it. So bureaucrats look at these micro schools, these non-traditional schools, these startup schools, and they say, oh, you are dropping a child off somewhere else and you're paying someone to care for them. You must be a daycare. You must be a childcare. You need a childcare license, right? The problem is there are a whole bunch of things that come with having childcare licenses. I'll give you a very simple example. I had a client who was running a micro school out of their home. And the bureaucrat came in and said, I'm the child care regulator. You are child care. Child care centers need fences around their playgrounds. And there's a good reason for that. We don't want sex offenders roaming our neighborhoods, picking kids off of playgrounds. So we insist on not just fences, but like tall fences, like chain link fences, preferably with like barbs on the top, because that's what we put in our administrative code to protect kids who go to child care centers. Well, if I'm running a child care center out of my home, and I have a backyard that kids are playing on, like all of a sudden you're going to put my micro school out of business if I have to be regulated as a child care center. So you say instead, ah, I'm a private school. I'm not a child care center. I'm a private school. Well, if you're a private school, then you need to have a principal, and your principal has to have a master's degree, and we have all these other regulations you have to meet in order to be a private school. I'll give you a simple example that relates to our earlier panel. Bathrooms. We'll have states that are even red states, our people who will pass a law. They'll say you have to have a boys' bathroom, and you have to have a girls' bathroom, and you have to have a faculty bathroom. You have to have three bathrooms if you're going to be a school. Well, if you're running a micro school out of your home, you maybe have one or two bathrooms. I literally had a client who had to go rent a porta potty to be the faculty bathroom so that she in her own home could go out to the bathroom, right? Like this is the challenge she was facing. This is, we ended up figuring out a different solution, but like that was what we were gonna have to do in order to keep her school open. Well, other times where a regulator comes and will say, oh no, we're a homeschool co-op, right? And this is probably the best option if you're talking to somebody who's running a startup school, is like, we're a homeschool co-op. Just not a lot of homeschool co-ops have websites and have staff that you're hiring and paying, right? Oftentimes, homeschools sort of operate in these legal gray areas, especially, frankly, homeschool co-ops, where the homeschool law will say, okay, you can be a homeschool. If it's in your home and you are the parent or you are the grandparent and you are providing the education, then it's a homeschool. You get an exemption from the compulsory education law. Mm-hmm. Well, if you go to the local church basement and you have one of the other parents teaching your social studies section, so you can run out and go do groceries, and then you're going to teach science in the afternoon while that parent is doing her groceries. It's not your child being taught by your parent, number one, and it's not in your home. It's in a church basement. And so, again, the regulator is going to come in and say, like, you're not really actually running a homeschool. And so we have all these regulatory boxes that we try to shove these innovative, non-traditional models into, and they don't fit. We layer on top of the education regulatory model, just the general everyday regulatory model. So something like fire code. If you're going to have a licensed LLC business and you're going to have at least 10 people coming to your home, then the fire code will say you have to have sprinklers, right? Maybe you're a psychologist and maybe you have a home-based office. Maybe you're a lawyer and you have a home-based office. And you can have clients come visit your home-based office, and that's not a problem. But the code will say, as soon as you cross X number, 10, you need sprinklers. Well, again, if you're dealing with a bunch of parents who are running a micro school with 8 families on a really tight budget, $10,000 to install a sprinkler system in your private home is just going to put your micro school out of business, right? It's just not going to happen anymore. Zoning. Again, if you're operating a private law firm out of your home and you have clients come and you just have somebody park in your driveway, not a problem. If you have 12 cars coming through your neighborhood every day at 7:30 in the morning and you get one annoyed neighbor who may or may not be a public school employee or public union member who calls the regulator and says they're violating the home-based business law because the home-based business law says you can't run a business out of your home if it results in increased traffic in your neighborhood, all of a sudden you've got your regulator coming down on you. The third and final one I'll mention is the health department. You're running a pandemic pod out of your home, your church basement, or you even just have a space in a strip mall. You don't have a cafeteria, right? So there's a solution to this. All of the children just bring their own lunches, and then you don't need a cafeteria. Until that day that you host a pizza party. I had a client, got a letter in the mail from the health department. We hear you are running an illegal, unlicensed cafeteria. Well, how is that? Well, every other week on Fridays, you allow pizza, and that pizza is not individually boxed. If you get individually boxed slices, then that would be health code compliant. But if you're bringing in an 8-slice box and then you have a teacher, even a teacher wearing gloves, slicing that, you know, taking those slices and putting them on individual paper plates for your kids, that's a health code violation and you can't do it anymore. And so my client stopped doing pizza parties until we could find a place 25 minutes away rather than 5 minutes away that could provide individually boxed pizzas. So I use all of these examples, I think, to illustrate just how our regulatory system affects every aspect of our lives. That shouldn't be a novel observation at the Federalist Society. And frankly, my clients are often on the wrong side of the law in every individual instance, right? Like the zoning code says, if you have more than 10 cars coming through a neighborhood, you can't do it, right? There's no legal argument to be had that they're not running a cafeteria or in need of a fire code. Like they say what they say. I think what it illustrates though is that our regulatory systems simply aren't set up for innovation. Our regulatory systems aren't set up for creativity. They aren't set up for non-traditional systems. And in this instance, when you have the forces of the education status quo who are trying to defend their ground from challenge, from innovation, we're just going to find more and more of these fights. I think, honestly, if the people from the previous panel win some of their parents' rights cases, it will actually help, right? Because then yes. We'll be able to say there is a parental right here that deserves at least some recognition when we're weighing these various regulatory frameworks. Mm-hmm. It may be that we have to end up with a new regulatory framework that's specific to micro schools or specific to these one-room schoolhouse settings. But even then, you get into problems because, like, I have clients who run two-room schoolhouses, right? They've got an elementary school side, they've got a middle school side. And like all of a sudden, if you have a one-room schoolhouse law, you're out of luck, right? And so really what we want is educational systems that are diverse, that recognize pluralism as a fundamental value for our country. There's a wonderful professor, I'll close with, Ashley Berner at Johns Hopkins University, who writes on this. She says, we fight a lot about education in the United States, districts against charters, choice against teachers' unions, parents against school boards. But in most democracies, school sectors aren't pitted against each other. Rather, the norm is educational pluralism, where places as diverse as Canada, Sweden, Indonesia, Belgium, and Israel, the system is built around choice and quality. So one of the ironies of our push towards educational standardization is that the people who champion diversity, liberals, actually want all of our educational institutions to look the exact same. They want all of our schools to run on this Thomas Dewey model from a century ago, and they want every school to look the exact same. Now, those schools may be internally extremely diverse, right? They may go 110% on DEI, super diverse. But creating that sort of system actually reduces diversity across the system because there's no cathedral high school. There's no Catholic high school that has Catholic values. There's no micro school. There's no options for parents. And so if we really are the champions of diversity, we should be pushing for this kind of institutional pluralism, this institutional diversity that gives parents options, and one of those options should be the option to create a new school entirely and to create a new system entirely that changes and transforms and adds to the educational landscape. Thanks for having me this morning.
Well, thank you to all of our panelists. I'm sure you all have a great many questions that you could ask based on those presentations, and I will give you an opportunity to do so. First, I would like them each to have opportunity to respond to each other if they so choose. And so let me start with you, Leslie. Do you have anything you want to say in follow-up to the other panelist presentations?
Oh, absolutely. So my standard joke is if I'm asked to speak on a panel and I get, 10 to 12 minutes, like, did you say minutes or days? Because I could go for days on all of this. I've been advocating for educational choice since the mid-1980s, which was officially before there was an official movement for school choice. So I've seen a few things over the years, and thankfully Indiana has been really the birthplace of a lot of innovation. People are moving to Indiana just to do education here because there's so much innovation. So just want to put out a little plug for Indiana. So Seamus mentioned something about the 16th lands and about how when the country was first founded in the states, they would dedicate certain acreage for the support of public schools. So people would grow crops and they would rent the land and that would go into a common school fund and you couldn't touch that. That's still the same way today. Those common school funds are found in almost every state. But the 16th acre language, okay, that's real old school. That's from the founding of the country. And I know that because in each one of these cases, doing the historical research has become really critical. Okay, today we talk about education, but what does it mean? And does it mean the same thing that it meant to our founders when they used similar language in the beginning, or did it mean something different then? So anyhow, that's been fun. But here's a fun fact. I was in Wyoming testifying recently, and as I was sitting there waiting for the bill to come up, the lobbyist I'd hired came in, tapped me on the shoulder and said, come on outside. So it went out there in the hallway and they said, okay, I don't really have anything to tell you. Sorry, but the bill that they're hearing right now is the one about curriculum and the books in the schools. And I just happen to know that there's going to be a woman there and she's going to read from a book that's in the third grade library that it's pornographic. And you'd be embarrassed to be sitting there and listening to that. Okay, well, that got my attention. That kind of puts this whole question about the books and curriculum and parental rights in the proper view. If I would be embarrassed to be listening to what children are being taught to read, okay, that's a problem. So for me, representing Milton Friedman's ideas, of course, I always go to Milton. And Milton said there's a big difference if you're using your own money or if you're not using your own money. So, with public schools, one of the biggest problems we had was apathy. For the longest time, parents would say, we put our kid on the bus, kid comes home, we're good. Don't really need to do more than that, everything's fine. That apathy has gone away, by the way. I mean, that went away fast over COVID. But it occurs to me that what if the parent was handed funding? So now it's the parent's money to decide how to use it. If you want to send your child to that school where your child is going to read books that would embarrass you if the child came home with that book and read to you, maybe you wouldn't want to spend your money there. Maybe you choose a different school. And maybe it wouldn't be something dramatic like it is across the country today, but it'd just be the parent's choice. And if a parent wanted to make a different choice and say, yeah, I think that's appropriate, my child should learn that, well, then you'd spend your money there. But again, putting, this is where the economic driver comes into play with respect to culture. When it's your money and you're making the decisions on how to spend it, then your choices may be something different than what the state chooses for you. So there's that. The other thing is with the 16th section lands, I want to get back to that. I went a little bit off on a tangent. Sorry, there's a lot to say. My lobbyist is a rancher. And said, oh, yeah, that 16th section business. Yeah, I kind of checked to the state every month. I was shocked to hear that that old system is still alive and well in Wyoming, and I think it's probably alive and well in some of the other western states. So, you know, so some of that is still going on. And then just quickly, I would say this. The intensity of interest among parents across the country is just something that we have never seen before. It has gone way off the charts. So here's an example. In Indiana in 2011, we passed the nation's biggest voucher program. And we were really hoping that we might get as many as maybe 5,000 parents who might sign up for a voucher for the first year. I think we came in at like 4,800, and you know, and we worked hard on that just to let people know here's something that you could do. In Iowa, that just recently passed their education savings account, which is universal, in 2 days they had 10,200 applicants. So they're getting applicants at the rate of 5,000 a day. Parents really, really want this. This is happening. So what Daniel was saying about the regulatory piece, this is something that we all need to really pay attention to, because school choice is just going off the charts. Parents are, they want it, they're demanding it. And if we're not ready to handle the influx of parents, and certainly if our systems are not able to handle it and are not able to handle that level of individual liberty and freedom, well, then I think that should be a lesson to us. We have a problem with the level of individual and freedom that is not in our regulatory system. So maybe this is a bigger issue again. I think, as Emily had said, maybe for another FedSoc panel.
Can I jump in real quick? I'm going to let you guys talk. But since we're talking about the numbers and how much they have changed, I wondered if you could comment on whether there are, and any of the three of you, what accounts for the shift in momentum on this issue, and are there lessons in that for other policy initiatives, for example, the parents' rights movement or any other sort of similarly minded movement?
Well, I would say quickly that COVID brought along an awareness of parents. Like I said, the apathy before COVID was palpable. It was tough to break through the apathy of parents, and that's just gone now. It's just gone. Now parents, they know something about education, and they know what they don't like. I can't tell you how many parents came to me and said, my kid's teacher gave me a lesson plan, and now I'm supposed to be the teacher? And, you know, they're really indignant about that. And then in like a whole stream of consciousness, and then said, and, well, I could do that. I could do that. Maybe I'd do it differently. And, you know, so parents learned that they can do more than maybe they thought they could do. And let me assure you, this applies across all education levels, across all income levels. Some of the strongest, best parents that made the best choices for their children in education were parents who were the least educated. The woman I met years ago, eighth grade education, drug addicted, sold drugs sort of on the side to keep going. She was homeless. She was sort of in and out of her child's life. she approved for her child to get one of those Pat Rooney scholarships to go to a private school that the nuns had connected her with. Again, kudos to the nuns. And I asked her why. You know, why did you do this? This is not part of your normal life, your life experience. How did you know that that was going to be good? And she simply said to me, "You will never know what it means to not be educated. You will never know that. I know that. I do not want my children to be like me." There's a very sobering message from her, but she was completely right. I'll never know what that feels like. But that's a huge motivation for an awful lot of parents in similar situations across the country.
If I can just quick, so sure. One way in which I think the school choice movement has changed fundamentally in the last 2 years, that frankly is a real challenge for us. Historically, the school choice movement has always been about helping poor inner city kids get a different option. And oftentimes those bills have been done in a bipartisan way. That if you look back to the Milwaukee School Choice Program, you look back to the Cleveland School Choice Program, there were people like Pollyannette Williams and others who were African-American Democrats who just finally said, "I am willing to take on the teachers union. It's that bad. And as a Democrat, I know I'm going to get primaried. It's worth it." And there were people who were willing to step up and help our friends. And that was the school choice movement up until now. The school choice movement has had to make a choice in the last 2 years. Are we going to take sides in the culture war in a whole new way? Because the demand from parents is no longer about low-income inner city kids. It is every parent in every district. Right. It is rural, it is urban, it is suburban, it's right. Everywhere. And so we had to make a choice as a movement. Are we going to champion those parents, knowing that we will never get another Democrat to vote for these bills? And are we going to just take sides in the culture war? Are we going to say, this transgender stuff is crazy, the bathroom stuff is crazy, the library stuff is crazy? Like, you have a right to exit, use it, get out. And I think we've made that choice. I think the politicians who are our allies in the fight have made this choice. I don't think we're gonna get Democrats to vote for any of these bills anytime soon. And it was totally the right choice to make because we have more momentum, we are passing it in more states, we are reaching more kids. And when we say, as a movement, your right to educational freedom shouldn't be based on your zip code, that should be just as true for suburban parents as it is for urban parents. We've been saying that for years about urban parents, saying just because you're in a crummy zip code doesn't mean your kids should have to go to a crummy school. Now that principle is working in reverse. Just because your kid is in a suburban school district that's actually pretty good, but is indoctrinating them in terrible ideas, doesn't mean you have to go there. We'll give you a better option.
I think one of the, I could just speak to Indiana because I focus just here in Indiana, but one of the observations that I have is that, of course, the largest enrollment in Indiana is still by far traditional school corporations, but the second largest enrollment is traditional school corporations who have open enrollment. Mm-hmm. So right. They don't have residents within the mm-hmm. district, but they're going primarily to a neighboring school district. And I think a lot of the reasons for that is maybe they live in a large urban district and they want to have a much smaller environment, or vice versa. I think you have examples of a family that wants this kid into a program that is very specialized, but can only really survive when you've got the volume of students that are participating in it. So I think that is that's one of the major issues. And I think you have the legislators that candidly remind some of the opponents of choice of that point, that you know the traditional school corps who maybe have a more difficulty with enrolling their own residential students because of declining population, that they have the opportunity to essentially recruit neighboring students to their program where it might be more appealing to that family.
All right, now I'm about to hand it to the audience, but first I would be remiss having three lawyers here, we've talked a lot about policy and politics, but there was a significant development just this last week with the authorization of St. Isidore of Seville, a Catholic virtual school that's made a lot of headlines with the Oklahoma, you all can correct me if I'm getting the details wrong, but the state of Oklahoma approving a charter school that would be run by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Oklahoma City and the Diocese of Tulsa. And so I'm wondering, obviously that's a new development policy-wise, is in your view, as lawyers, is this just a short step from the Espinoza and Carson regime that we're working in, or have we? Is it a quantum leap? And how are other states responding? Are other states poised to follow suit to do other things in that ilk? Please, anyone.
Okay. So the Espinoza case, the Carson case, those are, I was deeply involved in both of those cases. There's another case that they're citing also, is, which was Trinity Lutheran. So let me give you a quick background. In Missouri, they had a state program where they had a bunch of tires and they'd broken up the tires into pieces and it made good playground material. So people could apply for that playground material. Mm-hmm. Trinity Lutheran Church applied. They had one of the best applications. And first they were granted and then they were denied the right to get this rubber for their playground because they were a church. And that was the reason why they were denied, because they were a church. That case went up to the U.S. Supreme Court, Trinity Lutheran versus Comer, and the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, you cannot, in a neutral government benefit program widely available, you cannot deny participation simply because the applicant is a religious entity. The court went on to say that would be odious to the Constitution and a great violation of the First Amendment. So that was Trinity Lutheran. I could tell you that we saw that as also a school choice case. That would have huge applicability, but we stayed out of it lest we, blow it up. So didn't. But then the next one was Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue that originated out of Montana. Montana passed a tax credit scholarship program. The legislature said that a parent could use the funds at a religious school. The Department of Revenue, in handling the regulations, again, said, oh no, that would be unconstitutional to allow a parent to use the money at a religious school. So Kendra Espinoza sued. The Institute for Justice represented her. The Institute for Justice is fabulous. I've been working really closely with them even before I started working at EdChoice. If you don't know them, you should. Represented Kendra. Kendra had two daughters. She with the scholarship, sent her children to a religious school. And the reason why she did was because at their public school, her daughter and their friends, they were really sick of the boys. Boys were always teasing them. She told me, she said, you can only swing on a swing so many times, and then it's just boring. So she and her friends formed a little Bible study group at recess just because it would be more interesting. And then they were bullied, and school wouldn't do anything about it. And she needed to leave. It was really imperative. Her grades started to drop. She started getting really depressed. Anyhow, got the scholarship, went to a religious school, then it was taken away, and then the U.S. Supreme Court got their hands on it and said, oh no, you weren't listening when we were talking in Trinity Lutheran. You cannot deny an entity for participating based on the status, religious status of that entity. To do so would be violating the First Amendment free exercise rights of the parents in this neutral, widely available benefit program. The parents' rights of free exercise would be violated if the parent is prohibited from choosing a religious school for their children. Well, then Maine came along. And the Maine case started while Espinoza was still going. To be honest, we saw the Maine case, Carson versus Macon, as being almost supplementary to Espinoza. You know, when you're taking litigation up to the Supreme Court, maybe you get there and maybe you don't get there. It's a fun ride, but it's a little, can be a little wild, unpredictable. But the court, at the district court level in Maine, it was the same thing. Maine said you can't use the money at a religious school, but then said, oh, well, no, you actually can use the money at a religious school just as long as they don't do religion. As long as there's no religion at the religious school, then we're okay with that. Yeah, they said that with a straight face. So at the district court level, the judge said, nobody really cares what I have to say, so good job, lawyers, and I'm shipping you up to the U.S. Supreme Court. We lost at the First Circuit Court of Appeals, but the First Circuit Court of Appeals twisted the case a bit and shifted this case from a status case to a use case. So then the question was this. If a state constitution says that you cannot use state funds for religious purposes, is that an appropriate basis to deny these parents the right to use their scholarship money at a religious school? The U.S. Supreme Court told Maine the same thing they said to Montana. In that Montana case, Espinoza, the Supreme Court told the Montana Supreme Court, you said that our ruling would not apply to you. It applies to you. Did you go to law school? What? Yes, it applies to you. Maine tried to do the same thing and said, oh, no, the Trinity Lutheran case, the Espinoza case, well, that just doesn't apply to Maine. This is just a state constitution situation. And the U.S. Supreme Court did not mince words saying, yeah, our decisions apply to you. They, every day, they apply to you. And if your state constitution is more restrictive than the federal constitution, if your state constitution denies a citizen's rights under the federal constitution, it will not stand. Those were really big decisions that came down. And because of the use decision out of Carson, in particular, this became then the basis for the Oklahoma situation. The Oklahoma charter law says that anyone can apply to start a charter school, but you must be secular. You cannot be sectarian. And it goes very specifically to the dollars would be used for religious purposes. And so the people who want a private religious charter school is the proper name for it, are resting a great deal on that Carson decision. I can tell you that an oral argument before, I think it was in the Espinoza case before the U.S. Supreme Court, the attorney was asked by the justices about, well, won't this lead to direct state funding of religious schools? And the simple answer was, nobody is asking for that. And that was very true. School choice programs, make no mistake, fund parents. There is no school choice program that funds schools. They fund parents. That was critical to what Milton Friedman had to say in 1955. That has been a critical element in all of these cases that I've been talking about for over 20 years.
So let me start very quickly because Leslie mentioned Espinoza. So I had an amicus brief in that case, and it's the only brief I've ever filed with a comic in it. And it was a school. It said, like, faith-based school. And then there was a mom and her child who were obviously African-American. And then standing in the schoolhouse door was this bouncer wearing a T-shirt that said ACLU. And he said, you can't come in, kid. It would violate your civil rights. Right, this is the logic of the other side. So, since we're in Indiana, I have to say, like, Nicole Garnett at Notre Dame is the godmother of the religious charter schools idea. Since we're at a Federalist Society event, I have to say, if you're pro this position, pro-religious charter schools, the Oklahoma Attorney General's office, under the previous Attorney General, has an excellent AG opinion written by Mithun and Zach that I think lays out the best legal argument that's publicly available in favor of this. I agree with it, but I will make the opposite argument anyway, because there are lots of people who don't agree with it. And most of them are charter schools. The charter school industry, and it is an industry, is very much opposed to the concept of religious charter schools. And frankly, it's because a lot of charter school people are liberals who want to support some sort of education reform, right? So you have people like Arne Duncan, Obama's Secretary of Education, who support charter schools, and they want to be public schools. This is like extremely important to them that they're public schools. They're just charter schools and they're different. And having religious operators come in is going to ruin that self-perception they have that we are public schools. We're just a different type of public schools. And so there's a real split within the charter. Actually, there's not a split. The entire charter school community is against this. And it's fundamentally because they believe that they are public schools. They're just a different type of public school. And any type of public school could not have a crucifix in the classroom, right? Any type of public school could not open the day with the Lord's Prayer. Like, we've had those cases. The Supreme Court has said you cannot do it. And so charter schools are just in this sort of weird place where the chartering entity is a public agency. It's a state board, it's a local school district, it's a county or municipality. So it's a public entity issuing the charter. But then you have a private operator. Some of the operators are nonprofits, some of the operators are for profit, but just in the world now, like, that's how it works. And so the question is, if you have a private operator who's a nonprofit who happens to be the archdiocese and they want to operate it as an archdiocese would operate a school, like, where does it fall on that line? And are we really just pushing labels? Like, does the statutory label, because a lot of these charter school laws will say charter schools are a type of public school, does that statutory label matter? I think this act, this will go to the Supreme Court, but it will go to the Supreme Court potentially even before we get to this point. There's a case coming out of the Fourth Circuit called Peltier. Just went en banc like last year. Now it's up for cert on whether or not charter schools are subject to Section 1983. So again, we have this weird, you're a public school, but you're also operated by a private entity. And so the charter school movement actually briefed, yes, please make us legally liable under 1983. Mm-hmm. We want you to be able to sue us under 1983. Right. And I have actually sued charter schools under Section 1983 mm-hmm. for violating their students' civil rights. And so the charter school movement was like, we want to be public schools. We want to be viewed as a public entity. Please let us be sued under 1983. And yet you had the conservatives on the Fourth Circuit, to the extent that there are any left, a small but hearty band, all joining dissents in that case, saying no, these charter schools are different. They're different. These are private operators. They're not subject to government control in the same way. And so the state action doctrine that would allow a private operator to get looped into public liability under 1983, it shouldn't apply to them. So if the court takes this case, there's not really a circuit split on this question. Maybe a circuit split on this question. But like, if the court takes this case, I think it will lay a lot of the groundwork for it. And I'm sure Professor Garnett will have an amicus brief telling the court exactly how to resolve this case in a way that doesn't screw her out of having religious charter schools.
Yeah, and I should mention with this too, yeah, Nicole and also her husband, Rick, right. Both of them are at Notre Dame Law School and friends of the Federalist Society. They really are the best voice on this. They lay out the arguments really clearly. And I should also say this, because Nicole and I have had long conversations about this. I mean, there's no question that a public school is not to be doing religious things. That's not really the issue here. And the Peltier case out of North Carolina is case in point. The question is, are these charter schools operating as private schools? Now, the reason why there's some conflict here is because I can tell you, as you know, starting one of the first charters here in Indiana and being involved in the charter movement from early on, that it was a big deal for us to say, there are public schools. Mm-hmm. so many times I had to keep saying they're public schools, public schools, public schools. We all had to say this. This was a big mantra. Yep. And then we made it. Okay, they're public schools. It's great. Okay, but maybe they're not now. So there's a whole cultural shift in the education reform movement that, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around this. But the thing to keep in mind, and this goes back to the regulatory issue, again, that Daniel brought up, is that the level of how schools are regulated may have something to do with whether the court considers them to be state actors or not state actors. And that's really the question before the U.S. Supreme Court right now, is a charter school a state actor or not? It's not an easy question to answer. So I would encourage you to follow this Peltier case. The Solicitor General for the United States said, no, you shouldn't take this case. Sort of an okay argument, not strong enough necessarily. I mean, most people, most lawyers in this sphere and who are working at the national level and watching all of this stuff happening, kind of think they'll take this case. So I would encourage you to follow that one. And that will probably happen before the Oklahoma case comes up. Although I will say Americans United for Separation of Church and State, there's some adversaries of ours. They are the ones who said that they will sue against the Oklahoma private religious charter school. And they are, in my opinion, some of the best lawyers of the adversaries. So that also, if you're interested in this issue, that is also something to watch because you'll find good legal arguments on both sides.
More on the policy side of things, I think something you should be watching that I know Indiana is grappling with is the tension between traditional school accountability that is required by federal law, then, you know, evolved. I think the biggest example of that is A to F in school takeovers versus very much a shift to transparency. You know, showing the data, having dashboards, showing the books. And I think that's going to come at all levels. And even some of the staunchest supporters of vouchers and ESAs in Indiana, I think, have talked about, we do need to have some more understanding about how these public dollars are being used. So I think that is something to watch from even the most conservative legislators.
Okay. Well, I have to apologize because I definitely just ate up all of the Q&A time with that last question. It wasn't intentional. Jana, should I wrap it there? Or okay, I'm sorry, but I'm sure these folks would be happy to answer your questions individually over lunch if I may be so bold as to volunteer you.
Bring it on.
Thank you. I just have to thank you all very much for those learned and excellent comments. Thank you.